We're having a special class about circumcisions, Brit Milah. And as we begin the class, I want to just go around the room and ask you to do two things for me. Number one, tell me if there are questions you want us to deal with. And then, after we finish that, tell me what you know about a circumcision, just so I have a picture of what we should cover. So, you could throw out any random thoughts, what you know about a circumcision. Let's try to keep things clean here, okay? Yehuda, you have any questions you want us to deal with? Daniel?
Not that I can think of.
Sammy?
I really don't know that much. Apart from that, the basics. As long as it doesn't have that medical condition, which I can never remember what it is, that's it. And males only, otherwise, not it.
Okay. You have any questions you want us to deal with? David?
Me?
What? Yeah.
I remember learning something about that when a mom performs the circumcision, he pulls out the skin and actually forms something like a crown. And I'm wondering if that's correct or...
You'll understand by the end of tonight.
And what it symbolizes? What it's supposed, is it supposed to symbolize like a crown or...
Okay.
Like a shana?
If you want to deal with that, fine. Yosef?
No.
Okay.
I have something specific. I heard about some kind of god that's put on at the time of the Brit.
You'll understand. Fine, you'll understand that by the end of tonight. Okay. We'll get to that, Bezrat Hashem. Yehuda? We'll get to that, Bezrat Hashem. Okay. Say there. So, let's begin. Our story begins with girl falls in love with a young man, and her father is vehemently opposed to it. And as much as her father tries to convince her to break up with this young man, she refuses. And her father pleads, her father begs, her father threatens, until finally her father takes her to the local king and tells him, look, my daughter, she's not willing to marry the man I want. She's going on her own. I need you to deal with her. So the king takes the girl and tries talking to her. And then he tries torturing her. And then he puts her in a dungeon and tells her, look, you have two choices. Marry who your father wants, or we're going to put you in a cell for so long that you can forget it. That he's not going to wait around for you. It's not going to happen. And she refuses. And they put her in a cell. And every few days they ask her, are you giving in? No. And months turn into years. And after years, they take her out of the cell. She's been there 7 years. And they say, okay, now what? And she says, I still want to marry the one I said. And they say, okay, we're going to hang you. And they take her out to the gallows. And they ask her, look, you have two choices. Marry who your father wants, or we're going to hang you. And she refuses. And they take her to the gallows, and they say, we're going to count till 10, and then your choice. And they start counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And the king asks her, you sure? She nods her head. 8, 9, 10. They pull the latch. And she goes down, and the rope snaps, and she's okay. And the guy she loved, well, he took care of that rope. He made sure that she wouldn't get killed. And they finally release her, but she has to travel a great distance to catch up with him. And she travels and travels. And it's been years, it's been decades. Their relationship began when she was a youngster. And now, finally, She's overcome all these obstacles, and she comes and try to imagine what the wedding day looked like as the groom she fought so hard for after so many years takes the ring and says, "Hare at mekudeshet li, behold, you are my betrothed," and puts it on her finger. So, a few days after the wedding, she's doing her shop at the local market, and she has her ring, and she loves that ring, and you can see every few seconds she's looking down at that ring, and she's so happy to be married to this guy. And someone walks over and says, "No one around here, no woman around here wears rings. You're a weirdo." And she says nothing. And he says, "Look around you. No other woman's wearing a ring. I know why you're wearing a ring." So she doesn't say anything. And the guy says, "I know why. In case someone starts up with you and you want to sock him in the face, so you're wearing that ring, so it has a much greater impact." So she looks at him. She looks at the ring and thinks to herself, "If only he knew what I did to get that ring on my finger." The whole story is a metaphor for Avraham Avinu. Avraham is going to be a monotheist, and his father says no. And his father fights him, and he insists, and his father takes him to the local king, and he insists, and he's thrown into a dungeon for years, and he insists, and then they throw him into a furnace, and no one promised him he'd come out alive, and they kept giving him a choice, and no. And then finally, after everything Avram's contended with, he makes his ascent to Israel, and finally, he has the pact with God, where God says, "We're going to make a pact, we're going to make a bond, and that bond is the Brit Milah." What does the word Brit mean? Brit is a covenant. Our engagement ring, our marriage ring with God, is that, the Brit Milah. That's our covenant with Hashem. So people look at it and they say, "I know why you're doing a circumcision, because it's healthy. I know why you're doing a circumcision." You don't know why we're doing a circumcision. We've been giving up our lives for 2-3 millennium over this pact with God. The Greeks killed us over it. The Romans killed us over it. The Christians killed us over it. Throughout Jewish history, starting with Avraham Avinu, we were so dedicated and we were willing to stand up to the test. So the mitzvah we're going to discuss tonight is a mitzvah that has technical laws, philosophical aspects. But we have to realize the mitzvah really represents the connection we have with Hashem. It is a mitzvah which a child, when he doesn't even understand what he's doing, has this mitzvah performed onto him. He is brought into the Jewish people in a way that he doesn't even understand, and it's going to be engraved in him for life. And I began appreciating the Brit Milah about 7-8 years ago. I had already circumcised my own kids, and we had a student here in Mahon Meir. He lives here in Jerusalem now. His name's Daniel. And he had a circumcision as part of his gear process. And there were many complications with his circumcision. He had had many infections as a child. And as he's lying there on the operating table, he hears the doctor going, it's a urologist, right? He's looking at it and saying, "Oh, boy." And he looks at the urologist and he says, "Is everything all right?" And the urologist says, "We'll see." And he says, "Am I going to be all right?" And the urologist says, "I hope so, but we'll see." So he has a circumcision performed after he's really had issues previously. And he comes back to the Mahon all bandaged up, and he's writhing in pain.
What happened exactly?
He had a lot of scarring from previous infections, and it was a complicated circumcision. And he's not yet a ger, he's not yet a Jew. This is the first step. He's doing his circumcision after he's learned and the Beit Din approved him. He's lying in bed, writhing in pain, and he goes out to take a shower, and the doctor told him when he goes to take a shower, he has to change the bandage. So he starts changing the bandage, and he's in such pain, he faints in the shower. Literally passed out in the shower. And the guys call me up and they tell me what's going on. So I came down to visit him, Bikur Holim, see how he's doing. So he's lying there in bed, all bent over. He could barely move. I don't know if he's awake, asleep, alive, or dead. So I slowly creep next to his bed. I sit down next to him. And he rolls over, looks at me, and whispers something. So I thought I heard what he said. It didn't sound right. So I said, could you repeat that? And I lean over and he says, it's so special. I'm thinking that's not, those weren't the words that came to my mind, you know. So I'm thinking, he's talking about my visit, right? That I came down to see him. So I said, Daniel, what's so special? So he says, I have in my body a covenant with God. I've been waiting for this day my whole life. The guy is lying there writhing in pain. And he's looking at me glowing and he starts quoting to me Psukim from Yechezkel, an English translation that he's known since he was a kid, telling me how special it is that he now has a covenant with God. So after that night, after that Bikur Holim, I walked away with a new appreciation to what's a Brit Milah, you know? I don't remember. It's been a long time, a few decades since my Brit Milah. But he drove it home to me, you know. This is worth something here. And tonight we're going to discuss the physiological, medical, philosophical aspects of the Brit Milah. Feel free to ask questions. As we can go in many directions, and I'm not sure which points to stress, and that you guys will define as time goes on. We have another hour and 5 minutes until 10 o'clock, and wherever you choose, I'll give you an overview of the points I thought to discuss tonight, and then as we go through it, you'll decide where to spend more time or less. Yes, Yehuda.
Three questions. One, Dan, is Daniel his real name?
Yes.
Right. How could a doctor perform this procedure on him if it seems so risky from the...
Don't ask me, I wasn't there. I've accompanied many students to their circumcisions, but he wasn't one of them.
Okay. Will he be able to get married?
He says he's okay. He says he's okay. I have no idea what his condition was. According to him and the urologist, he's fine. I don't know, you know, I don't know if the urologist was just being mean when he did that. He meant to be funny, you know. I think, I heard from other guys that this urologist thinks it's very funny to answer questions like that. You know, to show up to a Brit and say, oh, boy. I think it's his sense of humor. I don't think it has anything to do with the outcome. Okay, the points I thought to discuss tonight. The counting of 8 days from when a baby's born. When is a Brit not kosher? When do we wait for a Brit? How do we do a Brit? What do we do if a Brit was not kosher? The whole concept of Hatafat Brit. What's called an Arlo? Which part of how's the foreskin? How is it a part of the body? And what constitutes a foreskin? If we discuss the medical order of a Brit Milah, so we have the gauging of the child prior to the circumcision, the circumcision itself, how it's done medically, and the healing of the circumcision, where we'll also, God willing, discuss mitzitza, that practice that we have on tradition to suck out blood to ensure that the blood flow is adequate. How do we check if a Brit Milah is kosher after the Brit Milah? A comparison of our way of doing Brit Milah versus the medical world's way of doing a Brit Milah, and a little bit about the symbolism of Brit Milah someone asked us to discuss, and the philosophical aspects, which perhaps we'll start even there. Maybe we'll have to wait with that. We'll understand it better after we understand the physical aspects better. Okay, so that's in general what I thought to discuss. And again, you guys will guide me as to what you want us to stress more. Okay, so we know there's Brit Milah for a baby. Every Jewish boy that's born has a mitzvah to be circumcised by his father when he is 8 days old. And now the criterion for a brit, the baby has to be born. Okay, you're not going to do a brit in utero. And we count 8 days starting with the day he was born. Now it doesn't matter what time during that day he was born, meaning let's say a baby was born right now. So tonight, by Jewish law, once it's sundown, so then it becomes Friday. So tonight is already Friday. Technically, halachically, tonight is Friday. So we count. The first day is Friday, and then you count another 7 days, right? Day one is Friday, day two is Saturday, day three is Sunday, day four is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Day number eight is going to be the same day in the week because you counted day number one, the day you were at. So day number eight is going to be the same day the next week. Now, this is true in general. What happens if a baby is born on Shabbos? If it's a normal, natural delivery, we do a brit milah on Shabbos. If it's a brit that's on time, meaning it's on the eighth day, and it was a natural delivery, so then we do a brit milah on Shabbos, on Yom Kippur, every day of the year. Every day of the year is kosher for doing a brit milah. So far, so good? Okay. What happens? Yes?
You mentioned natural.
Right.
Does that mean cesarean doesn't...
If it's a cesarean, we will not do it on Shabbos.
Why?
Why? It's derived from the verse that it has to be a natural birth.
But for all other intents and purposes, you would do it 8 days later.
Correct. Now, once you brought that up, there's one more point to discuss. Sometimes a baby's born and he's in distress for a period, for an hour or something. So the halacha says, ordinarily we count 8 days the way we just described. And we don't care what time of day it was, so long as it was during that day. But what happens if the baby was ill? He had a high fever, and then it went down and he was fine. What happens if the baby had a terrible eye infection? He had an infection in his blood. He had some kind of condition which passed away after 3 hours. Okay, so now he was born tonight and his condition passed tomorrow morning, Friday morning at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. Okay, 12 o'clock. I had a case like that a few months ago. An alumnus of Machon Meir had a baby born on Friday. The baby had a medical condition. He got better from that medical condition at about 11, 12 o'clock Friday afternoon. Now the halacha says something else. Now the halacha says you have to wait 7 sets of 24 hours. That means the brit could not be until next week Friday after 12. I've had this case a few times already. One, when a baby's born and then in the first few hours he's under distress or there's some kind of medical issue, we say once the medical issue becomes serious, and the halacha has specific criterion for defining serious, then after the baby's cured from that condition, we wait 7 sets of 24 hours. Now sometimes the baby could be sick. I had one of my kids who couldn't be circumcised for 3 months after he was born. And then when he was fit to be circumcised, we waited another 7 sets of 24 hours. After he was ruled fit to be circumcised. We always give him that. Once it was something serious enough, we give him that time. Sometimes it's not serious. The baby's a little bit yellow. So you wait. Sometimes you have to wait one day. But you don't wait 7 sets of 24 unless it's something serious. Yeah?
What does it mean to be yellow?
So we'll get back to that in a second. Okay? So that's where what you mentioned, Eitan, is relevant. You're saying a C-section makes no difference. Technically, it makes no difference, but sometimes you could have situations where very often when we do C-section, it's because the baby's in distress. So there you'll have to consult your local Orthodox rabbi, whether it's relevant or not. Your job as a parent is to let the moel know that this is what happened. So far, so good? Okay.
7 sets of 24 hours.
Meaning, let's say the baby got out of distress at 12 noon, you wait 24 hours, that's day one. And then another 24, and then another 24, and then you hit Friday, next week Friday, 12 noon. So then you wait 7 sets of 24 hours, 7 times 24 hours, before you will be able to circumcise that child. So sometimes a child has a fever, sometimes a child has a very bad eye infection. There are all kinds of issues a child could have that'll pass. Sometimes the child has to be put in the incubator for something serious, sometimes for something minor. Depending on what, very often we will wait those 7 sets of 24 hours and the brit could not be done earlier. So ordinarily, again, in a classical case, we wait 8 days. On the 8th day, in the morning, we already agree to circumcise the child. It doesn't matter if the baby was born 10 minutes before sundown. If the baby is born right after sundown, so then you have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi, you enter the realm of Bein HaShmashot, and you have to figure out what to do. Okay, so sometimes a baby's yellow. What does it mean that baby's yellow? Well, when a baby is born, there are many changes that occur in his own development. and they occur very, very quickly within the first few days after a baby's born. Many, many changes. Now, as his liver is functioning and changing from living off of the mother, living in utero, to living outside, so it takes time for things to function normally. It takes time for everything, okay, there's a lot to discuss, but there's a process. Just like the baby has to take his first breath when he comes out, so too he has to take his first going to the bathroom, and takes time till he's going to the bathroom what he ate outside the uterus. Now, classically, when a baby's 3 days old, so he turns more yellow. It's part of the process of maturing outside the womb.
Right, his face or his whole body?
His whole body. Turns a little bit more yellow.
Yellow?
Yellow. Now, there's a condition called jaundice, which is where the liver doesn't function correctly. But this has nothing to do with it. This is a part of the development of the baby. Usually, 3 days after being born, every baby will become a little bit more yellow. And then it passes. Now, we have numbers for how yellow a baby is. A baby is ordinarily 4, 5, 6, that's normal. Once he hits 8, 9, 10, problematic. He hits 12, 13, 14, more problematic. 15, 16, 17, he has to be hospitalized. That means we have to watch over him and make sure his liver is functioning correctly. A baby turning yellow could be a sign that his liver isn't functioning correctly. So already in the days of the Talmud, they ruled that a baby that has issues with his color, he's too red or he's too yellow, we won't circumcise him until we know he's completely healed. And that's why Esav, when he was born, wasn't circumcised. He was so red, they were concerned. There was a medical issue with him. So today, the nurses, the moel, the rabbi, there are different traditions as to how yellow constitutes a problem. From what number do we say it's a problem? And do we also take into account in which direction it's headed? Meaning, if the baby was a 13 and then he became a 12 and now he's an 11, does that count? Do I care if I see it headed in one direction or not? So that different moalim have their guidelines, how they work. You'll work with your moel, you'll find out. But the regular tipat chalav here in Israel, the regular nursing station where they weigh your baby and check your baby, so many of them will also be able to check him. And Mohalim used to, I don't know if Mohalim still do, but in my day, back in my generation, Mohalim would train in looking at babies and telling what number they are by looking at a baby and seeing his color. I could tell you I never learned black babies. I don't know if I'd recognize when a black baby was yellow. And I'm not sure on a Yemenite baby. I've recognized Yemenite babies being yellow when it was very bad. I don't know. When I trained, I only saw a few Sephardi or Yemenite babies. I wouldn't rely on myself. A regular Ashkenazi baby, I know how to tell when he's yellow. A Yemenite, I wouldn't rely on myself. They could check it by the blood count. They could by a blood test. They could check it also with a machine they put on his forehead, which checks the color. Yeah.
Would you count 24-hour slots after the end of the yellow period? As well?
Depends on how yellow. Usually not. Usually, once he's not yellow, you can do a circumcision, but it depends on how yellow. Again, there are levels of severity. Okay, so we have this fantastic mitzvah that's a covenant between us and Hashem. What is this mitzvah? What's going on here? There are medical benefits to the mitzvah. We know that when a person is uncircumcised and he's intimate with a woman that has AIDS, he is 9 times more likely to get AIDS than if he were circumcised. That's why that's a long discussion. That's why the UN has funded millions of circumcisions down in Africa. We know that people who are circumcised are far less likely to get cancer because they have far less infections, because the foreskin, as we will see in a minute, the foreskin causes that urine remains and then infections develop. So a person can be very clean, but still, it's not as simple as it sounds. At any rate, all these are perks and benefits. For the last 2 millennia, the world's been tormenting us and teasing us and even making rulings against us, saying no circumcision allowed. From the Greeks onward, we've been persecuted for circumcising. They claimed we were mutilating the body. It's only in the last few decades that the modern world has realized there are tremendous benefits to circumcising, medical benefits, but we don't know why God gave us this mitzvah. We're told it's a covenant between us and Him, between Him and us. And we have this mitzvah and we do it. It happens to be that there are many, many benefits, and we will discuss some of them as we go along, that we have now discovered when it comes to circumcising a baby. Yes?
So when they go and do Brit Milah, they get circumcised for those reasons, like in Africa, they just, you know, does that mean they now have a covenant with Hashem as well?
No.
Has no significance whatsoever?
Correct. Maimonides holds that for the descendants of Yishmael, there is a mitzvah to circumcise. But that's not the generally accepted opinion. Okay, so what is a circumcision? We all know what the male organ looks like. You have the part of the organ that looks like skin color. And then you have the top of the organ with a little rim going around it that's red. Okay, so that's a male organ. Fine, we know what it looks like when it's circumcised. Now, the way God created us, we have, when we're born, we have a skin that comes up from the stomach all the way to the top over the organ. And that skin is what we drew over here, the external skin that comes out and covers the organ from the stomach all the way up, covering up the red part, what's called the gland, what's called in Hebrew the atara, the crown. The red from the rim upward is called the atara, and this skin comes from the stomach all the way up here. So far, so good?
Mm-hmm.
We're all together? Simple? Easy? Fine. Our tradition is that the mitzvah of circumcision requires us to cut this skin from beneath the rim upward, meaning all the skin covering from the rim upward has to be removed. So, if I were to do something very simple, I can make a slit over here and just cut around the rim, take scissors, cut around the rim. That's easier said than done. It's not really doable that way, but we'll assume it is doable for a second. And, because, you know, that's like saying, imagine, I'm just going to cut the skin around the arm, right? How are you going to ensure you're not going to cut veins and who knows what else over there, right? That doesn't work that way. But in a second, we'll discuss how we actually do it. But what are we looking to accomplish with the circumcision? What we're looking to accomplish is to take this skin from the rim upward and cut it off. That's the mitzvah of circumcision. Remove the foreskin. What's the foreskin? The skin that's covering from the rim upward. That's what's halachically defined as the foreskin. So, what?
From the bottom of the rim?
Correct. So far, we're all together?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, when we look at skin, so different types of skin have different levels of elasticity. You could pull your cheek further out than you could pull the skin on your hand, right? And the greatest elasticity is in the male organ, because the male organ is built in a way that when it's hard, it could be 6, 8, 10 times the size of when it's not hard. So the skin on the male organ is very flexible. You could stretch it very high. Now, what we do practically is we take the foreskin, we take this external skin and pull it up. So that way I could slice it off without cutting the gland. So what we're doing is we're taking the skin, we're putting it between our fingers, pulling it up, and then cutting it off. So in up until 200 years ago, the way they would do circumcision is they'd come to a baby, look for where the rim protrudes outside the skin here. Now, when you squeeze on this skin, the organ goes down, and you remain with the skin in your hands. They'd pull it up. They'd ensure that the organ was down here, and they'd pull the skin up. They'd feel it. They'd make sure the organ was here. And then they'd take a knife and do this, and that was a circumcision. So that's the way the Yemenites did it. In a second, we'll discuss how we do it today. We do pretty much the same thing, but we use a guard to ensure that we're not going to hit the gland. Yes?
What did you say about the Yemenites?
The Yemenites, some still do that today.
Nobody else does that.
I don't like to say nobody. I'm saying, you know, everything's possible. Okay, so about 200 years ago, in the days of the Chasam Sofer, they came up with the following idea. You realize that circumcisions are happening by the hundreds every day. So if they're happening by the hundreds every day, maybe there's a way to ensure there aren't mess-ups. Because, you know, if the mohal feels, how many mohalim, you know, theoretically everyone gets it right, but it's like dentists. Usually the dentist gets it right, except for when he doesn't. You know, he's dealing with teeth all day. Now, my grandmother had the wrong tooth pulled out. My wife's grandmother, blessed memory, also went to top dentist, and he gave her a filling in the wrong tooth. And this is a dentist that's used by the Knesset members. He's considered mamash, one of the top dentists in the country.
Still?
Yeah. Still.
He's so, he had to make a mistake.
There's always a desire to ensure mistakes don't happen. You know, when my son had a hernia operation, so the doctor took a marker and made a mark on which side he was supposed to operate. You want to make sure he's getting the right side, right? You think, I could see it, I know. No, and this is a doctor who's like a top surgeon. He takes his marker and he makes a sign. You want to make sure. So the same thing with the circumcision. We want to make sure there's no room for error. So what was developed 200 years ago is what's called a magain, a guard. Bezrat Hashem, next week I'll bring you my tools, my equipment. I pashut forgot to bring it tonight. I wasn't coming from home. And this shear was decided upon about 3 hours ago. So Bezrat Hashem, next week we'll bring it in. You guys could see the tools.
Is that the metal thing that had a little slit in the middle?
Correct. So it's basically built very simply. What you have is you have a metal slab which has a slit in the middle, and the slit is very wide. I mean, it's wide enough that I could fit in my skin into that slit. It doesn't hurt the baby. What you do is you lift the skin up and you put this metal guard, which is basically, again, it's a flat piece of metal with a slit in it, and you put it on the skin to ensure the gland can't come up, and you cut over that. And then you've done your circumcision. So far, everything clear? Okay, so now let's understand two things. Let's draw a situation where we've pulled the skin up. And then, let me ask you, do you all visualize where is the wound? Where is the baby really bleeding? People think it's the red cherry on top. Not at all. I didn't touch that, right? Where did I cut? I cut down here. I cut under the gland, under the rim. That's where I cut the skin. So all the bleeding is going to be down here. People are always so concerned about the red thing on top. That's only because it's red. Nothing happened to it, right? So the gland, the red part of the limb, nothing happened. It just got uncovered. So if we are going to draw a situation of a post-circumcision, what we have is we have our gland. We have this, and then we have that same external skin with a cut. Right? Clear? The skin was cut over here, and this is where the gland protrudes on top, and here we're going to have a scab, and that's, in a nutshell, that's our circumcision. So far, we all understand, yes?
Where
the scab is going to be all of this.
When it seems like it's separated from the...
It was cut. It was cut. You can't cut exactly here. You're not going to be able to cut exactly there. You lifted the skin upward. So the cut is slightly below the rim. And there's a little section that has to scab.
Beneath the rim.
Ah, okay. Correct. Here's the cut. And beneath the rim is where I need a scab.
Does the scab essentially kind of join the remainder of the foreskin to the gland itself? Or?
We'll get there. Now, when we do adults, so you understand there's a much broader section here that's being cut. It's a much bigger limb. And the veins are much bigger. So you have a much bigger problem of bleeding. Stopping the bleeding is more complicated. Ensuring that it doesn't get infected is more complicated. And that's why an adult circumcision is so much more painful and also requires stitching. And we'll discuss later... if you guys are interested, we'll discuss how an adult circumcision is performed. Generally, the circumcision is the same. Post-circumcision, to ensure proper healing, is a little different. Okay, so now we have to add a little twist. When you have a person that's uncircumcised, so his gland can protrude through the hole of the foreskin. And what happens is... you can have a situation like this, where you have you have a picture like this, where basically you have an external sleeve, an external skin, and you have the gland protruding over here. Because what happens over time is this hole, the hole of the foreskin gets bigger, and then the gland starts protruding. And sometimes the hole becomes so big that the whole foreskin can droop down, and the guy could look fully circumcised. Because the foreskin falls down around the gland, the hole becomes very wide, and then you could have a situation where you see the gland, everything looks like he's circumcised, but really, he has a foreskin that's down like a sleeve all the way on bottom.
What age would this be?
What?
What age would this be?
That's a tough question. Let's say in regular adults, so it will usually happen because he's intimate with someone. Or because he always cleans the hole, meaning what makes the hole get wider? So what makes it get wider is that when he has an erection, the gland protrudes through the hole. And it keeps protruding wider and wider. So as he grows, the hole is wider and the protrusion is wider. And it depends physiologically. I'm saying most uncircumcised adults do not have this. This is not the common way it looks. The common way is that a person that's uncircumcised, well, his gland is going to protrude something like this. You'll see a little bit of red sticking out, and the majority is the foreskin covering it, for the majority of it. But I'm just saying, why is this important? Because I had people come to me who thought they were circumcised because they saw their gland, they thought they were circumcised, but they weren't circumcised at all.
How could you tell?
There are many ways to tell. Number one, if when the person has an erection, he can pull the skin over the red part, so that then he has a foreskin. So every person can tell when he wakes up in the morning, if a person wants to tell if he had a kosher bris, so most people when they wake up in the morning have an erection, if they can take skin without like killing themselves and pulling it like crazy. I'm saying if with the normal pull, you can take some skin and put it over the red part, over the gland, so then that means that either he wasn't circumcised or they didn't do a good enough job circumcising him. He still has part of his foreskin. Remember, there's a long skin over here. The skin goes all the way from the stomach up to cover the gland. So then the skin from the gland downward is not foreskin. You're going to have skin out here which is flexible, which could be pulled. How do I know if legally, if halachically, there's foreskin left? I check when the guy has an erection. Is there skin that can be pulled over the gland, over the rim? That's how I can check. Any person can check himself and see if his circumcision is kosher or not. So far, so good? Okay. Now, there's another way to check, but I'd rather explain that at the end, because then I'll be able to explain it better. I'll explain it now in a coarse way, and we'll refine it later. And that is, if the person was cut as a child, then there should be a scabbier. There should be a change. The skin that scabs is not identical to the skin from the stomach. So if I'm looking at the skin from the stomach going up towards the gland, what I should see, we're going to define this better later, but what I should see is a line and then a change in skin color going up towards the gland. Because if he had a circumcision, then the skin from the stomach upward is the original skin, and then there should be a scab. Again, to be defined better later. Yes? Yes, very often it will, and we'll explain why soon. We'll explain why soon. It depends on what age they did it. In a minute, we'll understand better. No, if a non-Jew does it, so then I did one this afternoon. I came here special this afternoon.
If
a non-Jew does a Jew, so then the halacha says that he should have what's called hatafat dam brit. Right, which doesn't even hurt. I've asked everyone I've done it for. None of them say it hurts, including the one I did this afternoon. Everyone walks around in this tremendous fear. Go tell a person, I'm just going to prick you in the most sensitive part of your body, and it's not going to hurt, believe me. It's like the dentist when he's about to give you the shot. This is just going to pinch a little, right? You call that a pinch? Wow. But no, I can tell you I don't accept payment for it, and I always say the one thing I ask you to do is tell your friends that it didn't hurt. They won't believe me. They should believe you. So this I do for anyone. I do it. I do it. Sometimes I do two or three a day.
Pricking the penis is all the blood out.
A person could technically do it to himself, but I'm scared he'd wound himself. Technically, and we'll discuss where you do it in a second. I can't explain it because there's more to be explained. I did it to a guy once where what we do is it's a slight scratch, meaning it's such a slight scratch that he doesn't feel it. So sometimes, I don't know if you've ever had this, you have a scratch and there's like a drop of blood that's not coming out, right? So I did once a guy, I did a slight scratch and I see there's a drop of blood and I'm trying to dab it with the tissue and I can't get the blood out. So I said, do me a favor, do your own atafah, just squeeze it for a second. So he grabbed it, squeezed it, and then you got a little drop of blood. The smallest is enough. Usually, I have to dab it with the tissue and I say, I'm done. And he says, you didn't do anything yet. And I say, yes, I did. And he says, no, you didn't. I didn't feel anything. And I say, okay, look at the tissue. And he looks at the tissue and he can't find it. And I say, look real closely there. You'll see a tiny, tiny drop of red. That's your atafat damrit. Because so then he looks and okay, fine. I see that little drop. Okay. Is that enough? Yeah. The smallest drop that was done by a Jew for the sake of the mitzvah. And again, we have to do it by daytime. Don't call me 20 minutes before Shkia like one guy did to me. He called me 20 minutes before Shkia and I came right away because I know that people walk around with this fear and when they finally make this decision, I'm going to do it. It's not easy. So I don't want the guy to walk around scared, oh, tomorrow it's going to happen. So I hopped in a taxi and I went. But try to do it whenever, okay? Whenever you want, you could give me a call. At any rate, coming back to our story. So there are more details we have to understand about a circumcision, meaning, imagine, we just said that the external skin can slide all the way down. So what's ensuring that no dirt or nothing goes down in between the skin and the flesh? So God created us with another layer of skin that runs like this. It runs from just under the rim, it runs up top, and connects up here to the hole of the foreskin. So we have another layer of skin. There are really two layers. There's the external skin, and then there's another layer of skin that comes from just under the rim and connects to the top of the hole. So if a person were to stick his finger into here, which people do, if a person's not circumcised, he has to clean in there. He can't stick his finger beneath the rim because there's a piece of skin that comes up from here. Now, a little piece of information for you. Probably the most sensitive part of the male organ is this internal skin. And there's a lot to be discussed. We'll explain it in a minute. So what do we do? If we have this skin that's coming out from just under the rim and coming up and connecting over here. So let's skipped an adult circumcision first, and then we'll come back to a child circumcision, okay? Just because it's simpler. What?
I still understand. Even if there's another thing of skin connecting to the tip, it's still between the flesh and the skin. There's still...
I'll draw it on the blackboard. I was just having mercy on our viewers.
Okay.
Colors don't have it. So, if we have this skin that comes up here, and then we have another layer of skin that comes from here, connects up. Okay? So now, if you want to stick your finger in after he urinates, right? The urine can dribble into here, but it won't go beneath that. It's got nowhere to go. Now, this is where uncircumcised people get a lot of infection. Because the urine can get caught here. So he says, no, I clean myself. We once had a German guy here, a Jew. He said to me, of course I'm uncircumcised. Life's much more fun that way. So I said, what do you do about infections? So he said, my father's a doctor. I clean. He taught me from when I was a little boy to clean down. So I said, okay, fine. And what do you do with all the liquid that stays there? That doesn't get moldy. Saying, you can't really dry in there. You can, right? Okay, whatever. He was a Jew. That was that's why I was trying to convince him to do circumcision. But whatever. Yeah.
This is a two question that I should be asking anyway.
You can ask whatever you want.
Is it more enjoyable doing sex?
100% it is. I was going to get to that.
With or without?
A person who is uncircumcised enjoys intimacy, the physical aspect of intimacy, more than a person who is circumcised. And there's a very simple reason for it. He has more skin. So he's going to sense much more of what's going on than a circumcised person does. What?
More
nerves, for sure. 100%. And I checked this with the people who converted here, who were adults. Who, you know, we had a guy here who was 50 when he did his circumcision. I said, you know, Maimonides writes, and the guy to the perplexed, that the pleasure is diminished when a person is circumcised. So I asked him, is it true? So he said, it's different. He thinks it is diminished, but he said, it's so different, it's such a different world, he has a hard time gauging it. But I think most people will agree, it's only logical, that pleasure is diminished when one is circumcised. Okay, so, what do we have? We have that drawing, and we have this skin that comes out from just under the rim and runs up till the foreskin, till the whole of the foreskin. So now, if we want to do circumcision, Jewish tradition, it doesn't say this anywhere. Our tradition is that, I mean, it says it in the oral law, it's not written anywhere. Our tradition is that after you cut off the foreskin, you have to take this skin, make a slit in it, and peel it backwards over the... you make a slit, you take the skin, the lower skin, you make a slit in it, and then you peel it backwards, and then it sticks itself down here. So now, if we are going to draw a situation post-circumcision, what we have is... Let's see if this will work. Will this destroy the markers if I draw on that? On paper?
Okay.
You're right, we do. You'll always cut a part of it, because it's attached to the top. It's impossible not to cut it. You're right. You're going to cut part of it. A very little part of it, though. Correct. So, because remember, it's attached to the bottom. It's not pulling up with you completely. You're stretching it, but it's not pulling all the way up with you. Correct. Okay. So now, let's imagine the following scenario. Our friend over here had his foreskin cut, right? That's what you see over here. His foreskin's been cut, and he has this lower skin that's still attached up here. And as Avram correctly pointed out, part of it is going to be cut, because part of it was attached to the top of the foreskin, right? We said it attaches itself, it's attached to the top, to the whole of the foreskin. So part of it is going to be cut, but most of it is going to be up here. So what do you do? If you're going to try to push it back, it'll climb right back up again. So you tear it in two, and then you push it back. Now that hurts the baby. If there's one part of the circumcision which is probably the most painful part of the circumcision, it's what people don't even know happens, and that is when you cut that skin in two and pull it back, because this skin, again, is the most sensitive skin the baby has. It is even more sensitive than the skin, than the external skin on which we do the circumcision. But this is stage two of the circumcision, and in Jewish halacha, this stage is called piri'ah. Piri'ah, the uncovering. And this skin is called Orha Piri'ah, the skin that gets that has to be uncovered. That you really, you peel back the skin. You cut it in two and peel it back. This is the Orha Piri'ah. The foreskin is the actual skin, that skin color, what you see on the outside. After you cut it off, so then you remain with the gland, but the gland is covered with another layer of skin, which is called the Orha Piri'ah.
What's the Piri'ah?
Priya, the act of Priya is when we tear it in two and push it back down.
What do you mean by push it back down?
Oh, so then we peel it backwards. Imagine that this is the gland, and this is the Orha Piri'ah, from the fold of the sleeve upward. So then I'm going to push it down like this. I cut it in two and I push it down. I fold it backwards.
So you cut it as well?
We cut it, we make a slit, otherwise you couldn't peel it back. You make a slit, and then you peel it back.
And then what's of it? Now it's peeled back.
It's peeled back, and it'll glue there. It is fully attached. It is attached to the bottom of the rim.
That's what I mean. So it's
attached to the bottom of the rim, but it's folded backwards. We'll draw that now. We'll draw that right now. And now I could discuss what you raised earlier. So post-circumcision, really, it looks like this.
Well, earlier you discussed about the whole thing of pulling up, stretching up the foreskin, so there's no chance of cutting the gland. But what is there, but now you're cutting an even closer skin, the gland, how is it?
Give me one second, one step at a time.
Okay,
so we have our cut. This is where we cut the foreskin. And this is the revealed gland. And this is where I peeled back this skin from up here. I make a slit and push it back down. So I fold it back down over the revealed part of the flesh. Meaning you cut the foreskin and then you have some flesh that's revealed just under the rim. And you peel it back to there. Now you guys have seen a full Brit Milah. This is how you do circumcision. Halachically, we just finished the circumcision. We have the healing parts of the circumcision. We aren't yet done. We haven't bandaged him. Now,
What?
I said that's not for the circumcision. That's for the healing. That's not a part of the mitzvah. We'll get to that in 1 second. Now, there is one more point just for you to understand. As adults, when we do a circumcision on adults, and this is what someone asked, is a hospital circumcision identical to a Jewish circumcision? So it's different in many ways, but the one of the ways in which it's different is that we also, when we do adults, what we do is we take this skin and we sew it down to this, to the skin that was cut. So we take the skin, the Ara Priya that was folded back, and we sew it up with this, with the foreskin that was, it's not foreskin really, the external skin that was cut after we stop the bleeding. So we stop the bleeding by cauterizing or by sewing the veins shut. And then we sew up the Ara Priya that's folded backward with the skin that was cut. And this is a way of ensuring that no infection can come in. And these are the stitches that you'll see around the Brit Milah. Now, technically, if you'd ask me what's best for the child, so I would say, leave him with as much or priya, with as much of this skin as possible. Because if we just explain, this is the most sensitive skin there is, so that means that the more you leave the kid of this skin, the more he's going to enjoy life later on. Right? Simple. And the Torah doesn't obligate you to take any of it off. You have to peel it back, but you don't have to take it off.
Even if it's folded back, it's still a pleasure? 100%.
Because the way an uncircumcised person works is that when his gland protrudes through the foreskin, that skin really folds back. What happens is the gland, when he has an erection, the gland will protrude through the hole, and very often it will go all the way through and come out, and then the skin peels back, and that skin peels back naturally anyways. So that's really the natural place for this skin by most people. Some people have an erection and their gland will only protrude or drop. But by most people, it protrudes the whole way out, and then that skin folds back in ways. And there's an amazing thing about that skin, that when that skin is folded this way, it's red. When it's folded back, it has skin color. I only noticed this when I was present by some of our Ethiopian students, when they asked me to come along for their Brit Milah. So there, it's very obvious. When you fold black the skin, suddenly you see black skin color. You see, it's folded back. It's like the skin was meant to be back. you see that when it's folded back. Okay, so now...
What color is it when it's folded back?
It's skin color, meaning the lower side, this side, the side that's folded upward, is really skin color.
So what if it's not folded? What
then it's red. It's like... Yes?
So does the orb...
But by the way, on a baby you won't see this. It's so small you can't see anything. You don't, I mean, this skin is tiny. Yeah?
So does the or priya merge, let's say, scab together with the remainder of the skin?
Thank you. So that's an excellent question. I would just like to address one more point before we address that. Along comes modern medicine and says, this isn't a nice circumcision. Leaving the aura priya, leaving that skin over there. Cut it off. Leave the child with a very minimal amount of skin, of this skin, the Ara Priya skin. Netano Frankenthal comes along and says, who are you to say what's nice and not nice? You guys are harming the child. Why cut it off? The kid's going to enjoy life less. But who am I? The court of Israel ruled against me. I didn't go to court, but other Mohalim did. there were mohalim, there were people who did circumcisions and left the child with this skin, which in my opinion, they were doing the child a favor. The parents went to get the child checked, and the doctor said, "What kind of mole did your kid? Boy, what an ugly bris." So the parent comes home and says, "What an ugly bris. Really, what do you know?" "Nothing, but that doesn't matter." Took the moel to court and won. And today, legally, if a moel does this and leaves the child with the full skin back here, he runs the risk of being sued. All it takes is one doctor or one nurse telling the parent, "What an ugly bris." Okay, now you go risk it.
What's the point?
So they say it's much nicer if it all scabs as one. I don't know who gave them the right to say what's nicer. But that I'm telling you what's accepted today legally. It's not, you know, one doctor said. The courts have ruled on this. Today, if a moel wants to leave a child with the full skin, so what do they do today? We'll discuss a bris how it's done today. Technically, you could take this skin instead of peeling it back, you could just cut it off. We make a slit in it. But in a second, you'll understand better. There's much more to be discussed in a second.
We talked about sewing it.
I said by adults. Adults get the full skin, it gets sewed. So now, wait, we'll get to it. We still have more to learn. We're not yet there. So, post-circumcision, you look at a child. From the stomach going up, you have one color skin. Let's draw this. Okay, so you have one color skin from the stomach going up. And here's what it looks like. So you have the skin color coming from the stomach all the way up. Then you have the cut. Then you have the scab. And then you have a final color that's from the rim down. The final color from the rim down is this skin that was folded backwards. Just under that you have the scab. And just under that you have the skin color going all the way to the stomach. So when we're checking a person, when I check an adult to check if his bris was kosher, one of the things I'm going to look for is the different scabs. I'm looking from the stomach coming up is skin color, and then one line, and then the color changes very slightly. Yeah, it took me about 300 or 400 adults before I was able to see it, to notice the difference. When you train, okay, you see one after another, eventually you learn. But I'm giving you the explanation. I'm not saying you'll necessarily recognize it on your own kids, but so from the stomach coming up is regular skin color, and then you have the scab, and then the final color that goes from the rim down is the color of this skin, the ora priya, that was folded down. So far we're all together? No. What's bothering you?
I don't understand where the ora...
The ora priya is here, right? You folded it backwards.
In that diagram, you just did the...
In this diagram, you don't see a separate skin. It all looks like one skin. It's all flat. Meaning between when it heals, all you see is a slight color difference.
So this is where you haven't taken off the aura priya?
When you take off the aura priya fuses with the flesh and just connects there.
When you peeled it back.
You peeled it back, like in this picture. You peeled it back.
Like modern medicine does and cuts it off.
Even when you cut it off, you can't cut down to the rim. You're going to have something left. You can't cut everything.
So you're saying, and it's not like this loose, this movable top of skin.
Sometimes it is if the moel messed up. It shouldn't be. Sometimes if the moel did a circumcision in a way that there was no place for it to stick to the flesh, so then you could have a situation where the person has a flap, where the aura priya basically is flapping down and it's got nowhere to stick to, and then he has another piece of skin there. Right, that can happen. I had a phone call a week or two ago from one of our alumni who says that's what he has. I'm not sure. Again, I'm going by his phone description, but based on his description by phone, that's what he has. Yeah.
I'm sorry, would you explain now that you explained that? Would you mind going over that diagram quickly one more time?
So again, you fold back the aura priya and it attaches to the flesh, and it becomes one with the flesh. Then you have a scab, and then under that you have the skin that goes down to the stomach. So when you're looking, you're going to see from the stomach coming up one color skin, and then a line, and then another color. Again, the shades are very slight. And then finally, the color that goes directly under the rim.
So there are three colors.
Correct. But again, you might not notice it. To you, it all looked like skin. You never noticed you had three colors, right?
What is that small section there? That
now, this tiny section up here is Ora Priya, because I'm assuming you don't have a lot of Ora Priya, because all of you are young, and now we'll explain how a Brit is done today. What we do today is, when a baby is born, so this skin, the Ora Priya, is glued onto the gland. It's not attached, but just like if your mouth is dry and your lip sticks to your teeth, so too this skin is like stuck onto the gland. So about 35, 40 years ago, there was a Rav named Rav Piratinsky, and he invented the following method. Before the bris, we take something that looks just like this, like a pen, a dull instrument. We stick it into the hole over here, and we go down and we just pass it around the gland. And what we're doing when we're passing it around the gland is really we're just separating the Ora Priya. Why do we want to separate it? Because we want to save the baby some pain. What we're doing now is, when we're going to take the foreskin and pull it up, we're going to take the foreskin with the Ora Priya, together with this skin. Avram correctly pointed out that you're always taking a drop of the Ora Priya, because the Ora Priya is connected to the foreskin. But if I could separate it before the circumcision, so then when I pull up, I'm going to get much more of it, because there's much less pulling it down. If it's glued onto here, so then I'm going to have a very hard time pulling it up with me. I'm pulling through two skins, right? But if I separate it, so then I'm going to get much more coming up with me. And then I'm going to end up cutting, when I cut, in one cut, I'm going to cut off the foreskin and at least half of the Ora Priya. And then I have a situation where the Ora Priya just falls down. I don't have to cut it in two, because I've already cut half of it, and it falls down and it glues down to here. And that's why today, most of you, that's how you had your circumcisions done. And then you have very little over here to glue on without cutting it, because you really cut it with the circumcision. One cut finishes it all. Now,
isn't there going to risk that you stick the needle into the...
Yeah, but it's not a needle. Nothing will happen. So you'll pull it out and you'll start again. One of the checks we do as Mo'alim is we stick it into the hole. Not deep, but a drop. We're checking for something the hospitals don't check, which is very common. It happens to 1 in 200 babies, but we don't have time to discuss it. We're checking for a certain condition for the baby's benefit. One of the things, if you're going to check a baby 3 days before the bris, so one of the services I do as a mo'al is I check the baby for that condition. Hypospadias or hypospadias. But again, I don't have time to explain that. Yeah?
Is that initial thing painful when you separate that little piece?
No.
And also, do you put like a vast oil or something to... Is it a dry piece of metal?
It's dry. We're trying to keep the place sterile. This is an operation. It's a minor operation, but it's still an operation. So,
and I'm saying, when you cut that initial, let's say you don't put the instrument in, and you cut the foreskin, does blood come out of the actual, around the flesh? Does it start bleeding around the flesh?
The blood is going to come out of here, the flesh, and out of the skin that was cut. In truth, it comes out of more places, because what happens is the veins are pretty intricate here. And you don't have control of where you're cutting the veins. You're pulling skin up and cutting. But so what really happens is that you have blood coming out of the flesh, and you also have blood coming out of the veins. Now, where are the veins? Imagine this is the gland, and my sleeve is the skin that was cut. Okay? So now... Really, we do this sometimes. If you want to stop the bleeding, you pick up this skin between the skin and the flesh and you look. And you will see little drops. Sometimes you'll even see it pulsating. Yeah, you'll see that it's like a larger vein that blood is coming out of. And so we stop the bleeding. I mean, sometimes, usually you hope you won't get to that. Usually by bandaging it, that's enough. So now to discuss a little bit of how they do a circumcision in a hospital and how we do circumcision. So What we do is, we show up, we put the baby on the sanduk, we put the baby on the throne for Elio, we have a tradition that Elio comes to every bris, and he officiates every bris, and we honor him, and then we honor someone to hold the baby during the circumcision. That's considered like he was the altar, because circumcising a baby is like offering a sacrifice. You're not killing the baby, but it is considered, it is something very hard for a parent to do. Emotionally, it is hard. You're seeing your baby cry, it hurts. So the one holding the baby during the circumcision, that's considered to be a very big merit. That's called the sanduk. Traditionally, we give that either to a big rabbi or one of the grandparents. First the grandparents, then a big rabbi. Meaning if the grandparents are going to be present, if they're decent Jews, so then we honor for the grandparents first. And then by your third or fourth child, you could decide which rabbi you want to honor. So
where did that come from?
A different time. We're just very short on time. There's so much left to cover. So the person holds the baby, and the moel guides him how to hold the baby, and then the moel uncovers the baby and sticks in his little instrument like this, divides between the skins, tells the father, "You pointing me the shaliach?" The father says, "Yes." He says, "Okay, bris kodesh. I'm doing this for the sake of the bris." Because in ancient times, there were many people who used to circumcise for health reasons. There were illnesses that they knew you could cure by being circumcised. So we declare, before we're doing a bris, Shema Yisrael, you say, Hashem Lokeinu Hashem Echad. Just before the bris, the father declares, Hashem is one, I'm doing this for the name of God. I'm not doing this for medical reasons or other reasons. And then the moel, just before he does the bris, declares, Bris Kodesh, I'm doing this for the sake of the holy bris, the holy covenant. And he makes a blessing. Now, count in seconds, okay? The moel separates, takes the foreskin, puts on the shield, makes the blessing, cut. The whole process takes somewhere between 2 and 4 seconds. Okay? And the real pain of the baby is the cut, which takes somewhere between a half a second and 0.75 seconds. It doesn't even take a full second. It's somewhere around half a second. That's the baby's pain. We're done. The procedure's over. I'll bandage and everything. Now let's pause and go over to a hospital. How's the circumcision performed? Doctor tells the parents, we'll see you in 15 minutes. Everything's okay. Everything's beautiful. Doctor takes the baby into his ward and takes a machine called the clamp. What does he do? The clamp sticks in pliers, closes the pliers on these two skins, pulls them up. The baby starts being in pain. Next, you've picked up these two skins, and the machine closes another set of pliers on the foreskin. And the baby sits there for 2 minutes, withering in pain. The parents are outside. He's in the operating room. No one knows, right? The baby sits there withering, wailing his guts out for 2 minutes, as the pliers are held shut over that skin. What the doctor is waiting for is for that skin to die. His goal is to kill that skin, and then he's going to cut it, and there will be no bleeding. And he will come out and tell the parents, our circumcisions are so much better than that ancient way. Look at us, the baby's not bleeding. Right, how'd you get there? By torturing the baby. I don't know if you guys can imagine 2 minutes having that part of the body with a plier on it. They've been doing medical research in hospitals across the U.S. They've started adopting legally our way of doing a circumcision, because they came to the conclusion, they hooked up the baby to monitors, they saw the stress, they saw the duress, they saw the heartbeat, they saw the brain motion, the movements, and they said, this is ridiculous, you can't do such a thing to a baby.
Medical,
it's not to do with Jewish. I'm telling you, the halacha prohibits doing a circumcision that way. Not only because it pains the baby, there are halachic reasons why that's not a kosher bris. Now, why don't we... What?
It's not bris, it wouldn't be kosher.
Okay, that's part of the problem. Why don't we put anesthesia on the baby? The baby is 8 days old. And there are two ways of doing anesthesia. One is by giving him a shot. That's not healthy for the baby. There are all kinds of dangers to that. There are all kinds of dangers in doing that. And the other is a cream called Emla, where if they have, babies are sometimes born with a little extra skin tags. Like babies, sometimes they have little skin coming out near their ear. You guys don't see that too much today. So they cut that off for a baby. Here in Israel, they'll do the hospital will do that as service for you. Before they do it, for 40 minutes, they'll take some Emla cream. They'll put a bandage on with Emla cream, and that numbs the skin. And then when they cut it off, the baby doesn't feel anything. Why don't we do that with the circumcision?
I guess.
No, because the cream causes an allergic reaction. There are babies, there have been many cases. I've heard it already from the first time a doctor said it to me. He said to me, they brought me a baby that they put Emla cream on, and his male organ was this big. He's showing me with his two hands. So I thought he's exaggerating. This big, I can't imagine. I mean, this is the size of a tomato. I don't know, the size of four cucumbers. I'm thinking he's exaggerating. But then when I was doing some service in the hospital, the doctor also said to me, don't let them ever put Emla cream on you. I said, why? You know, I played it dumb. He said, I've had kids with Emla cream and they come in with an organ this big. So when two doctors put their two hands together to show you the size of one up in the north and one in the south, and they both tell you this big, yes, this big, not an exaggeration. You say, okay, you're talking about that his organ is almost the size of his head. That's the allergic reaction, and the baby has to be hospitalized for a long time. So this happens. It's not like a far out thing. So that's why we don't use the cream. I mean, that's the main reason. What's
wrong with the injection?
Also, medically, it's not. You don't give such chemicals to a baby. Everything's smaller, so everything affects him much more. The best we do is sometimes we give him a few drops of Acamol. We give him a little bit of a painkiller, like ibuprofen or whatever. And what we really do, which really helps the baby, is we give him a little bit of wine. We dip our finger in the wine, we put a little bit in his mouth, and then you see that the babies are relatively calm. I've done circumcisions where the baby, I always tell the parents, you know what, I tell the parents, your homework before the circumcision is every time you change the diaper, listen to the baby wail. Because what's going to happen is at the circumcision, that's the only time that you're doing nothing but listening to him cry. So suddenly it sounds terrible. But if you do me this favor, and for the next week, listen to his cries when you change a diaper, I guarantee that in the circumcision, he will cry less in my circumcision than your diaper change. And every parent has agreed that the baby cries more in a diaper change than at a circumcision. So that's a little bit calming, right? That's what our circumcision looks like. And so now we've basically covered the medical aspects of what we do at a circumcision. There's a lot more to discuss, obviously. But now we're going to shift to try and cover a little bit of the medicinal aspects. What do we do to help the baby heal? So the first thing we do right after the circumcision, we look to see it's a kosher circumcision. And then we do something which we have on tradition called mitzitza, what Yehuda asked about earlier. Mitzitza literally means sucking. We have on tradition that we have to ensure that there's adequate blood supply to the area after the circumcision. So, how do you do mitzitza? So the ancient way, the way they used to do it in the times of the Talmud, is that the moel would take a little bit of wine in his mouth, and he would spit it out over the organ, and then he would suck on the place he just cut to draw out blood to make sure there's adequate blood flow there. Today, that's a long discussion. But that's an ancient custom to put wine. Now, he sucks the organ, he's really sucking out blood, and then he spits out the blood. He doesn't swallow the blood. He spits it out of his mouth. You're not allowed to eat blood. What?
Couldn't you get infected if the baby had like an infection?
Oh yeah, you could, and the baby could, right? If the moel has all kinds of diseases, then the baby could get it. So, to date, on an average day, there are about 1,000 children that are being circumcised, and the moel is doing mitzitza with his mouth. I just saw such circumcision today. Every day, there are thousands of kids all over the world that have this done to them, and they don't drop dead, right? Most of us, most Jewish men, adults, who have had a regular circumcision, have had mitzitza done to them with the moel's mouth, and they're all living to tell the tale. So it can't be something too dangerous, right? Nonetheless, there are cases where the moel will have herpes or hepatitis B or C, or you could have situations where it would hurt the baby, right? So you don't really have to put your mouth on it. You could take a gauze and squeeze it, or you could, what I do is I take a syringe without the plunger inside. I turn over the syringe and I put some gauze pads inside the syringe and I put it down over the male organ and I suck on the syringe, and then you have the same effect. You have the sucking effect. So I'm doing it the traditional way without putting my mouth on the baby. So then you have the same effect where blood... No, because I put in gauze pads. It all gets caught by the gauze pads. It's 1 second of... So that deserves a much longer discussion about what does it help the child. Why did they say to do this? It could be that there are medical reasons why it helps the child, and it could be that they were concerned because one of the things you see as a mohel is that the veins, we don't notice in our arm if this vein goes a little bit more here or a little bit more there, right? The veins aren't built identically by each person. The same thing's true with the organ. The veins are not built identically. You don't have the same bleeding with two children. And so there are many theories among doctors why children who did not have mitzitza would die. Meaning the Talmud says, if you have a moel who does not do mitzitza, fire him. Don't wait to see what happens, because you're going to think all the babies are fine, and you're not going to realize that here and there, when babies die, it's because he didn't do a job correctly. Meaning it's not something that the average baby needs. It's very clear from the Talmud that it's something which the average baby is fine without. And when it would happen, you wouldn't necessarily know it had anything to do with that. So there begins the whole quandary. So what was their concern? So there are many medical papers written on it, many theories. They're all theories. We don't know. At the end of the day, we're not sure why it's necessary. There are theories which make sense. There are theories which don't make sense. I don't think it matters.
Could you ask one theory that makes sense?
So that's what I said a minute ago. That being that the veins, the structure of the blood flow could be different, there could be children where it is very, very important to ensure there's adequate blood supply. There could be a child which has the deformity we discussed earlier, hypospadias, which is pretty common, it's 1 in 200. And then when you did the circumcision, it could be that you affected him much more than any other circumcision. And then if you want to ensure the organ doesn't die, you have to really ensure there's adequate blood supply to the place. And it could be there are children who's... okay, we gave two theories already. There's more to be discussed, but we're out of time. Are there any further questions you guys want to ask? Yes?
Are you... Jewish if you haven't had a Brit?
Yes, every Jew is a Jew, but every day that a person doesn't have a kosher circumcision, so he is not whole. When God gave us the mitzvah of circumcision, he told Abraham, walk before me and be whole. And a person is considered missing something. And aside from that, he's missing the tremendous mitzvah. It is the only proactive mitzvah that has 13 covenants written about it. And there's a biblical punishment of kares for a person who doesn't ensure that he has it. So it's a very weighty mitzvah. It's weightier than almost any other mitzvah, the mitzvah of circumcision. But a person is halachically Jewish and all the mitzvahs apply to him. If he's a Kohen, he won't be able to eat truma. There are certain limitations, but technically he is Jewish. And yes, it's an important mitzvah, but he's still Jewish. A ger couldn't be a ger without a circumcision. Yeah.
Were these ancient cultures that were performing circumcisions, was that before the time of Abraham Avinu or after?
We only encounter it in the Talmud, so that seems like it was 2,000 years after. Okay. And the Medrash discusses that when Avram got the mitzvah of circumcision, he wasn't too sure what he was supposed to do with it. And his friend who said, I'll show you, and he did a practice run, died. Then Avram had to go do it, yeah. When Avram went to his friend, Aner Eshkol and Mamre, I think it was Aner or Mamre, one of his friends said, I'll show you Avram how to do it. And he wanted to be the first. He wanted to be able to say, I did the first circumcision. So he went and did it on himself first, and he didn't heal. He died. And then Avram had to go and circumcise himself after his best friend died from it.
So
yeah.
Our tradition seems to indicate that Avram was introducing that to
correct.
The world.
Yeah.
Not that, okay.
Right. But once it was around. Okay, any questions? Yeah, okay, class is over. Whoever wants to go can go, but we'll take whatever questions people have.
If a Jew discovers he didn't have a bris,
right,
and he wants to get a bris, but he's not psychologically ready, so with the Torah, he's still, like, would that curse thing still be hovering over him? Because he wants to do it, he's not ready.
So we have a rule that on the one hand, the person can't make up cop-outs for themselves, but on the other hand, God doesn't hold things against us when it's beyond our capacity. So if something is really beyond the person's capacity, it's not held against him. Yeah?
Have you ever had a time where, I think about myself being a teacher in the mission, where the father of the child is not being there during the birth?
Sure.
I'm really queasy.
I've had situations where parents told me I'm going to be standing very far back. I can't see what's going on, and that's fine.
They
do the bracha and they turn around. Most parents can't look. Sure. You can't really run away. You have to be up in the front. But I had situations where the father didn't show. I had a situation. I did a bris in. I shouldn't say where, but at any rate, I come and we make up in the afternoon. It's a winter day like this, and I told them, "Look, I'll come the time you want, but you have to realize we don't have that much time before sunset, so you got to be ready." So it's 45 minutes before sunset, and the wife brings the baby, and everyone's ready, and there are a few relatives there to celebrate. You know, a lot of people do the bris in their home. People, especially people who aren't. You know, either they're not so familiar with customs, or they don't have the finances to do something nice. So so the baby's on the bed, and I say, "Where's the father?" And they say, "Oh, he just went out for a smoke. He'll be back in a minute." Okay, I sit down with the safe. I get everything ready. 5 minutes, 10 minutes. They call him up. He's not answering his cell phone. 15 minutes, 20 minutes. I said, "Look. Today's your mitzvah, he's 8 days old. You got 15 minutes left to sundown." So they got the hint, he wasn't planning on being there. And though we did the circumcision without the father, he didn't show up till I left. And I was there for another 15, 20 minutes to ensure all the bleeding stopped and everything. He didn't show up.
Because he was squeamish or because he was...
I never met him, I don't know. Yeah.
Well, this is a general attitude, though, that we should have out of Brit Mila in general... someone else's child, and
then be at our own. That's a huge mitzvah. Eliyahu is coming to the room. That's a huge thing.
Imagine, Rabbi, this is the most important day of a Jewish male's life. This is the day that our covenant is sealed with God. Meaning, it's that day. The details, I'll spare them right now. It's a serious day, and it's a painful day. I want to know, like, what are we supposed to? What are we supposed to feel like? Obviously, it's not a day to joke around. It's a day of a very, very painful joy. That's what I could logically come to the conclusion. But what does that feel like? What is a day of painful joy?
Well, the pain is not as big as you're saying. I'm saying the baby is usually relatively calm. There are exceptions. There are babies that. I'm saying that the baby is usually nursing afterwards, and people do do enjoy the meal afterwards. People aren't sitting there saying, "Oy vey, the poor baby." You take good care of the baby, and it's something every man has gone through. And at the end of the day, it's more a day of joy than a day of painful joy. The way you're saying, you're right; it is painful to the baby.
It's serious. Like, how do you combine joy and seriousness? Put it that way. What's the mentality?
So some people actually do all kinds of things the morning of the bris. Some people go daven at the kotel. Some people go to mikveh before the bris. Some people make sure to give charity before the bris. But all these are like, whatever a person connects to. At the end of the day, the big thing is make sure you have a good mohel who you verified with someone that he knows what he's doing and that he's going to do things in a way that's responsible. And make sure you're taking good care of your wife. She's nursing. She's 7 days after delivery. It's not an easy thing for her. And usually you prepare a nice meal, and you should have a nice Dvar Torah. That's more than enough work. You know, if you're going to set up the meal and invite and tell people about the meal. We don't invite. We don't want to pressure people, but we do tell people about the the mitzvah and the meal. It's a lot of work. I don't hold of the people who go to mikveh and do other things because I have a hard time imagining that they're going to do it, and it won't be at the expense of helping their wife and helping set things up. Meaning you have a lot of practical things to do at a bris. You have to make sure you brought what the mohel told you to bring. The bandages, the diapers, the cream, whatever he asked you to get. You have to take care of your wife. You have to take care of the baby. You have to be a host to your guest. You have to ensure that the caterer or whatever food is being brought is being taken care of. There's so much practical stuff to deal with. It's really a simcha. There's a lot of practical stuff. So I don't believe that a person should spend so much time focused on the other thing. Make sure you have a good moil. Make sure you make your blessings the way you should. And make sure the babies and your wife are okay. Those are the big deals. Then you also have a responsibility to give honors to your in-laws, to whoever else is there. And to be a good host at the simcha. All the other things, you know, they're nice. But these are things that are your responsibility. And usually that takes up most of your time. You don't usually have that much time to do anything else. You're after 7 days, the baby hasn't let you sleep. You've been dealing diapers, helping your wife. There's a lot to do. Baby's born, you got to get the baby clothing. You got to make sure you have a crib, a carriage. So some of that stuff you get in advance. There are always last minute things. The nursing doesn't always go smoothly for the wife, so you have to get a nursing consultant. The baby is sometimes colicky. You got to figure out what foods your wife should eat so the baby takes better to the nursing. There's a lot to do when a baby's born. Check out the mother from the hospital, get the baby checked by a doctor or by the nursing station here in Israel. There's a lot to do. Aside from that, you'll have your job you have to keep up. People don't have time to do that much more. And again, I'm very concerned that when people do more, it's at the expense of their wives, which is really unfair. The woman needs a few weeks to recover. And in our day and age, people expect their wives to set up the bris and to be Mrs. Superwoman. And it's not right. It's much more important that he be there to help with the baby than that he should go around and say Tehillim, the whole Tehillim at the Kotel that morning. His responsibility is to help his wife. The other things are nice things, you know. If you have in-laws or sisters-in-law or good friends who are really, really there helping your wife, so maybe you'll be able to get away with going to mikveh that morning. Maybe. But more than that, I don't think it's fair. Yeah.
Why?
I'm sorry for being practical. Yeah.
Why does the father have to fill in on?
So that goes back to the Paskin Miguel Sester, Laihudim Oysa Ora Vesimcha Vesoson Vikar. So we have a medrash that those were the things they decreed against us. Orozu Torah, Soson, that's the Bris Mila, Yikar is Tfilin. So when we do the Bris, we also have the Tfilin on to show that we've overcome all the decrees against us which tried to abolish Torah and Tfilin and Mila. And so we put on the tefillin, and that's because of that pasuk, which stresses that the Jews still have Ora v'simcha v'soson v'ikar.
And then if it's the mole's first time, like who's going to trust that mole if he's never done it before?
So that's why I gave my children to my students.
You did what?
My children, I gave to students who I taught to do the bris, because I know it's perfectly safe. I know that after you put on the magen, and if you have a student that's responsible, so he's cutting on the shield, you know, that's not complicated. The complicated stuff is setting it up for the bris, or in a situation where the cut didn't go right, fixing things afterwards. Sometimes you have to cut again sometimes. So that's where it starts getting interesting. But if you do things responsibly and slowly, so then there's no real danger with the student doing anything. If he's a wacko, so you shouldn't have a student who's a wacko. But if he's a calm, responsible adult, so then once you set it up, what's he got to do? Go with the blade along the shield? You know, if he's going to do things calmly and normally, there's nothing that should go wrong. The only thing that can happen is that he'll do things a little bit slower or less competently than the moel. And then there is a certain element of pain to the child because he isn't getting the top doctor. But you know what? When you go to the emergency room and when a person goes and has an operation done, so there are very often students, the top hospitals are teaching hospitals. And then you don't even know what part of the procedure is being done by the student and what part is being done by the professor. You know the professor's there, but they're not going to tell you how much of it who does, right? You don't know. So in a Brit Milah, it's much harder. What makes a Brit Milah very, very hard is that you're standing in front of a crowd. Being a moel would be easy as pie if you could do it in an operating room. It's a joke. Set up the baby, tie him up, put on all the covers, pull it up. You do things at your own pace. No one's asking questions. You know, finished. You're a moel. Everyone's gauging you and watching you, and everyone's going to ask you a million questions. Why'd you do this and that, and shouldn't this have been different than that? Okay.
Are you as a father,
I tell people to go away. I tell all the children to go away.
Everyone's jumping on.
Right? It's a big pain in the neck. I once had a person tell me, excuse me, I'm trying to get a picture. I'm trying to do circumcision here at the Machon, and he's telling me, you know, you're getting in the way of my picture. I learned to yell when I became a Moel. When I became a Moel, that's when I learned to yell at perfect strangers. Today, oh, did I bark at him. Shabbat shalom. Shabbat shalom.
Do you have to cut with a knife, or could you cut with a scissor?
Technically, halachically, you may cut with anything that cuts. Scissor, or knife. The tradition of Israel is to use a metal knife ever since the days of King David. Until the days of King David, they used to do circumcisions with stone. And from King David onward, they do with a knife. It seems that the Karaites used to do it with scissors. And it might have been the Jewish way to do it with scissors prior to the days of King David. But the Jewish tradition is, already for millennium, more than one millennium, to do it with a knife made of metal. When a woman has that question, she should call. Well, technically, there's what to be discussed. Yeah. Right. It's a very good point. Okay. What else?
Okay, the bandage. Do you use a non-adhesive? Like, what kind of bandage do you put on?
I use 100% cotton, sterile bandage, because the best thing for the baby is just to put something sterile that'll stop the bleeding. That'll just.
Some bandages have these little pieces like of cotton, like it's stuck on the wound, you know?
Right. So the Talmud already says that when you prepare the bandage, the way we prepare it is we take the seams and fold them inward, and then fold it again to ensure that the seams where you have little pieces of string sticking out, they don't get caught onto the wound. So the way it looks is if this piece of paper, let's say, is the bandage, we fold the seam inward, right, like this, and we fold the bottom seam inward, and then we fold it over itself like this, and then you have a bandage which is all folds. But the seams are not going to come in contact with the baby. All the seams are folded into here, and then you bandage. Okay, excellent questions. Anything else? There's a lot more to say, but you know, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry for interrupting.
No problem.
I just didn't catch what you said about the operating room, how those doctors, what they do with the clamps.
Basically, what they're doing with the clamp is they're closing a clamp. Okay, that's why it's called the clamp. They're closing a clamp on the foreskin.
So they put it into the foreskin?
No, they pull the foreskin up the same way we do. But then they close the clamp on it.
And
they leave it like that for 2 minutes. The baby's writhing in pain.
He's just playing again.
You're waiting for the skin to die. You're closing the clamp and waiting for the skin to die.
So there's no blood coming.
Correct.
Do they do it even on infants?
I'm talking about infants on a one-day-old baby. Here in Israel, they do it. All over the world, they do it. How do you think they circumcise all the Arab children? They take them into an operating room and they do it the easiest way. No, I mean, the state of Israel will fund a circumcision for any person that wants, any person that can't afford it, so they'll do it in the hospital. So all the Arabs get their children circumcised. Many Arabs who are Israeli citizens will get their children circumcised when they're 1 day old, 2 day old, and then they do it in a hospital room and they do it the same way. They do it with the clamp. That's the medically accepted way to do it. Slowly, in the United States, slowly it's becoming more and more accepted, and the states are pushing laws to protect the babies to do it the Jewish way, without a clamp. So it involves a little bit more work in order to stop the bleeding, but it's much, much, much less painful for the baby.
Okay, one more question?
Sure.
Basically, in the states, they're writing the fact that doctors
depends who you ask.
Or are they mixing in? Maybe is that the problem? They're mixing.
Okay, so that's what they say. You know, this is how it starts. First, they tell you not to do this. Next, they tell you not to do that. And unfortunately, if you look throughout Europe, you see that there is a precedent that once the state starts getting involved with certain religious issues, then they take stances like no slaughtering animals and stuff like that. So the concern is more that if you have thousands of kids having it done on a daily basis and they're all okay, so then there are more dangerous things to deal with in life. And the question is, why would someone stand up against it? And at the end of the day, all over the world, people have been doing it and are continuing to do it. So that's why that camp is very wary. Hey, wait a second. Why do you want to change something we've been doing on tradition? And they hold it to be something that you shouldn't change, that it's part of our tradition. Technically, there is halachic room to do mitzitza in other ways. The Mishnah Brura quotes that you could do mitzitza by squeezing a gauze. Rav Hirsch writes, yeah.
And with a straw, is that because you're not getting the whole thing with a straw?
You are, because I take a very wide syringe.
Ah, you did.
I take a syringe which covers the whole gland, which covers the whole.
People take a straw like this, no? Like this.
I haven't seen anyone do that.
Oh, okay. Also, you said there's a certain way you could do it as a moral to be safe with the state of Israel, with the government. What about cutting that inner skin?
So the way we do it, the Piratinsky method that we explained, where you separate the Ara Priya, and then you pull them both up together, so then you end up cutting most of the Ara Priya, and then you're okay.
Ah, even if it's not all of it.
Yeah. You've still cut at least half. Yes. Okay.
Screw us.